This is the True Voice Media Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Gibbard. Back in 2011, I started a social business agency called True Voice Media. In 2013, I launched this podcast because my audience told me that they wanted to learn more about how social media could help them grow their business, but they wanted it to be interesting and without all the standard social media hype and BS. Just someone who will give it to them straight with honest, simple strategies that they can use today. If you're a new listener and that sounds like what you want too, listen to this episode. And if you love it, subscribe to our show. We'd love to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started. This is episode 52. Of the True Voice Media Podcast, and this is a very special one for me. I enjoy, obviously, every guest that I get onto my show, but for me, this is honestly a pretty big get. The man is Tom Asacker, and he is known as a brand strategist and an innovator, but I think typically you would describe that you are in the business of belief. Am I correct?
Well, that's what I try to teach, Jeff. Yeah.
Awesome. So I'm not one to deal in flattery or anything like that, but I want to just explain why I'm so excited to have you on the show. And that's because I've been following your blog for quite some time. I've heard you on some podcasts, and I think that you and I are kindred spirits in a lot of ways because of the way you present your ideas, the things that you think about. I just feel like, are you a whiskey drinker?
Vodka.
Okay. Well, I would have a whiskey and you would have a vodka, but you're the type of person I would love to just sit down with, you know, around a fire pit and just shoot the shit about what's going on out in the world, because I really appreciate the lens that you look through. You know, you talk a lot about identity and storytelling and brand and, you know, the noisy world we live in and all of these different things. And quite honestly, just from the notes I have from blog posts of yours I've read and things, I feel like you and I could have six podcast episodes, but I'm going to try and keep our one on track here. And I want to start off with, I guess first, for those that don't know who you are, I apologize. Let me start off with, can you just tell anybody listening who is not yet familiar with you and your work, who you are and what your career path has been, how you got here?
Oh man, that'll take 30 minutes.
Try and do it in two or less, because I got a bunch of stuff to talk to you about.
Let's see. Went to school to be an artist. My dad dissuaded me. He said there wasn't a lot of money in that. Switched to economics. There wasn't a lot of money in that either. Got a job with GE. Was an executive with GE. Bought out one of GE's companies from Jack Welch with a bunch of other managers. Got in a vision collision with my partners. Left there. Joined a startup medical device company, grew that like crazy for 5 years, ran into another vision collision with some investors, left, wrote a book, wrote another book, wrote four more books, and then have been speaking, consulting, and advising, usually big brands, for the past 15 to 20 years.
What's your day-to-day look like? I mean, are you working with clients on a regular basis? Do you have a lot of time to sit around and think? And I don't mean that like you're in your underwear just trying to come up with stuff, but I mean more, you know, you seem like a very thoughtful person based on the way you communicate and the depth of the ideas that you get into. So I'm wondering, you know, do you have time to stop and think if you're going from thing to thing? You know, what's your day-to-day look like right now?
You know, it's off and on. So summers for me are usually like they are for anyone in the world of business, whereas a lot of vacations, a lot of holidays, time off. So I have a lot of time off in the summers. Same things, same thing during the end of the year, the November, December time frame. There's not a lot of conferences. There are not a lot of meetings going on. So, yeah, I have months of downtime where I do a lot of writing, a lot of thinking. I have my own podcast as well with another guy. So, you know, yeah, I would say I spend a lot more time thinking than I spend a lot of time traveling. So that's all time thinking as well in the airports and on airplanes.
Yeah, and I think travel is one of those wonderful experiences that really does inspire thought, because it takes you out of your normal routine and causes you to look at things through new lenses. Similar to you, I have the end of the year where it's kind of slow. And what I like to do is every year I take the last 2 weeks of the year almost entirely off, and I read and I listen to podcasts that I had been bookmarked
and meaning to listen to, and I write and I strategize about the upcoming year. But I really appreciate that time because it gives me that chance to really mull over some things that I've wanted to think about and I didn't have the time to throughout the year.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. I don't think a lot of people are doing a lot of thinking at all right now, and we can talk about that.
That's a great place for us to start because, I think there's this term that gets thrown around a lot, and it's called thought leadership. And one of the things that I routinely say in a meeting with clients when the word thought leadership comes up, it's almost starting to feel like the word viral to me. It just has lost its meaning. And I say, one of the key components of becoming a thought leader, and this may surprise all of you, is thinking. So how often do people actually stop and think about their industry rather than just regurgitate something that they've been saying for 15 years about their industry? And I want your take on it because you do a lot of work talking to brands about how they present themselves. And I'd imagine you talk a lot about this idea of thought leadership or how they position themselves in all these different ways. What's your take on the current state of thought leadership?
I don't see much. To me, what it looks like is, and this is the nature of human beings in general, is that people aren't really making their way through the world trying to figure out, what the next direction is a year from now, or they're not taking this, like a bird's eye view. It's more like they're driving a car and they're looking for the best way to get to where they're going as quickly as possible without any problems, to save as much money as they can. They're not looking at the data like Uber, saying, well, where should these cars be? Where should we move them around? How should we increase the prices or decrease the prices? They're not doing that. They're so busy trying to get from one place to the other. And I know this to be a fact because if you ask people to share with you their model for how they approach the world, how they think about what they're trying to accomplish, they can't really show you one. And that's what I find very interesting. And I'm talking about smart people.
Yeah. What do you think so I guess I'm wondering, where does that come from? Because I think I write a lot on my blog and I think about the world around me. And I think part of what really kicked off my way of doing that is that I read a lot of Seth Godin's blog. And as he once aptly described himself on Mitch Joel's podcast, he started off by saying, I observe things. And I looked at the way he wrote about things, and that's ultimately what I saw myself doing, was looking around and noticing things and trying to write about it in a way that allowed me to explore an idea. And as I read your blog, I see a lot of the same thing, where you're looking at the world around and you're trying to figure it out. To your example about Uber, you're not just looking at where should the cars be, but do we even need cars? Like really getting to that depth of it. Where do you think either the people who are thinking on that level or who are trying to, or that get jazzed by doing that sort of thought experiment, where do you think that either comes from, or what do you think is missing that hasn't caused other people to trigger that part of their way of seeing the world?
Anytime you look at the world and develop any type of opinion that's going to cause you to stop and change direction, your mind typically will push that out. It doesn't want to stop and it doesn't want to change direction, especially larger organizations, because you have to get everybody under you to do the same thing. And people just don't want to pause. They actually believe that the faster and more they do, the more successful they're going to be, as opposed to the more strategic they are, the more successful they're going to be. So I think that's what it is. It's this dissonance in your mind when you say, wait, maybe I'm not doing the right thing. That's an uncomfortable feeling, because if you're not doing the right thing, that means you have to stop. You have to get everybody to slow down for a minute and reconsider what all their actions are. And I don't know too many people who want to do that.
So that sounds a little bit like there's some fear that's guiding that decision. And I'd imagine that is probably some of the same reasons why people don't write things that are extremely thoughtful about their industry or that take a counter type of view to it. Because if you think about the stuff that's going to get the most clicks and views and head nods, it's going to be the things that confirm our beliefs or biases we already have. And the things that challenge, those are going to be the things that may drive clicks, but they may not drive the attention and interest that you're looking for because they don't confirm it.
That's exactly right. Look, If you find what people desire and you give them more of that, then you'll be successful. And that's the problem with this idea of thought leadership, because sometimes a thought leader comes along and he's telling people something that they don't desire. You know, I mean, when Galileo came around and said, hey, the Earth's not the center of the universe, Aristotle was wrong. Nobody desired to hear that. The church didn't desire it. The public didn't desire it. And that's why they locked him away. So if you tell people what they want to hear, like the political candidates are doing, then they'll tune in. Tell them what they don't want to hear and they'll tune you out. And that's the dangerous thing for people. It's to be aware that what you're tuning into are things that are validating what you're doing. If what you're doing is not getting you where you want to go, you don't want validation on what you're doing. You want somebody to come in and tell you you're not doing the right thing. Let's flip that so that we can change what the outcome is.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up because, you know, I like I said, I have a tremendous number of notes on here, and I was reading through your blog again, and I came back over the post you wrote called The Trump Hoax. And I was like, should we go into the political territory? But I think, you know, without it becoming a political conversation, I think the point you raised is an interesting one, that telling people what they want to hear and that makes them feel good is exactly what is driving that, rather than necessarily what the real conversation, what really needs to be said is. And I think that I see a lot of that in my industry. So, you know, your industry, I guess it's hard to even describe. I know that you hate being associated exactly with branding because, you know, I know that you look at it at a much deeper level. But, you know, I think in general, I'm associated with the social media industry. I have a social business agency I've been talking about for a while. And there's a lot of things that I know people in my industry will say to clients, and they say it over and over, and it makes them feel good. But at the end of the day, 6 months later, when they look back on it, there's no results. And I come in and I say the thing that's what they need to hear, but it doesn't make them feel good about what they have to embark on. It's a long journey. It's going to take that hard emotional work, and they don't want to hear it. And I think that that's a real challenge in business right now, is that the game seems kind of rigged towards saying what people want to hear that makes them feel good about themselves rather than what they need. And isn't that bad in an entrepreneurial society that we're trying to create?
Well, it depends. I mean, if capitalism was working the way it was supposed to be working, then it wouldn't be a bad thing. But a lot of these businesses that are not spending their money to reinvent themselves, they're basically hoarding cash and just doing what people are telling them that they want to hear. And that's when it's bad for the economy and for society, because what they're not doing is they're not creating new businesses, creating new jobs. You know, they're just taking these things that are easy to hear, that are not risky, that don't require a lot of strategic thought and change, and they're employing these things. And it's not growing their businesses, and they can't understand why it's not. And that's what's shameful about getting people on some type of path that's not going to help bring the results, because the results are going to bring jobs and opportunity and growth for everyone. So that's why that would bother me. But I got to tell you, I don't think a lot of the people that are out there doing what you're saying, which is feeding these people what they want to hear, I don't think they're even aware that they're doing it. I mean, in order to go out there and be believable, you have to believe it yourself. So I think a lot of people are deluded in what their advice is. And
that just, you know, that one's a really tough one to chew on, because it kind of brings in a couple different things, and I'll let you kind of riff on this, but I'm sure you've heard of the idea of imposter syndrome, right? So you bring that into the mix, and you have the belief in yourself, and then obviously you have your self-doubt creep in, and then there's this idea that even if you were doing the wrong thing, you wouldn't know, which further exacerbates this idea of, you know, fraud syndrome. So how do we even know if we're on the right path? Or are we all just, you know, I think you said it in one of the things you've done in the past, that we're all a little mad, quoting, I think it was Mark Twain or someone like that.
Right.
Is that what it is? Are we all just a bunch of, like, you know, monkeys bashing our heads into each other to try and figure out what it is?
Yeah, pretty much. The thing that you don't see in business that really strikes me is interesting And I think I discovered this when I was, I'm pretty sure it was when I was running my medical device business. I thought that, like, I thought that the medical profession dealt with science. And then I went to like these trade shows and I saw nurses go to these booths that were giving away like big teddy bears. And I said, oh my God, this is no different than any other industry. This is all driven by people's feelings. It's not driven by data and rational thought process. And so it's understanding that that's how the human mind works. That is the tough thing. You know, once you understand that people's perceptions and feelings are what drive their decisions, not their thinking mind. Their thinking mind comes along later to validate everything that they want to be true. And that's why when people from outside of this country look at our political process, they say, what is wrong with you people? You know, they're not even making any sense. Well, yeah, they are making sense if you realize that to people today that are so confused and overwhelmed with conflicting data, they don't know who to believe. So in their mind, what feels right must be right. So if you're not feeding people what feels right to them it's wrong.
And this is that know, like, and trust thing really at its core. And it you know, it goes back to, if you've read Seth Godin's Linchpin or you know, Pitch Anything or anything about the amygdala and, you know, the lizard brain and everything. This is that, you know, essentially we're driven by our primitive feelings that then go up and, you know, look at it in the social context. And then we make our higher brain processing, you know, figuring it out logically. But, you know, if that's actually how things go, why are we still pretending all across business and everything that decisions are made logically, or that in the economics model that there's this rational man? Why is that still the thing if really everything is feeling driven?
Yeah, I think that the rational man myth was starting to fade a bit after the Renaissance, but I think what gave it legs and is really starting to solidify it was when the computer was developed. Because then somebody created this metaphor. They said, you know, the mind is like a computer. And as soon as they said that, everyone said, okay, we're rational. We're like computers.
Yeah, and the funny thing is we're nothing. Trying to make computers more like the brain now. So,
paradox. That won't ever happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's never going to happen.
Well, let's never say never, Tom. Come on.
It's not going to happen. The brain, it's a living organism. It's constantly changing. Unless we can develop a computer that can constantly change, you know, unless we can create computers that can have moods, right? I mean, human beings have moods. When you're in a particular mood, you look at something, your perception is one way. When you're in a different mood, you look at something, the perception of that thing is completely changed. So unless they can make a computer look at tooth with the same thing on one day and have a different perception of it, then it's not going to happen.
You know what though? This is okay. So now I want to pick your brain on this, because I want to turn your own stuff back at you here. You talked in the past about fact versus truth. All right. Mm. Give me the quick definition of the difference between fact and truth, if you could, for anybody listening that hasn't seen this.
Oh man. Actually, it's harder to determine what a fact is, but a fact is objective reality.
Yep.
Right? So we are on this sphere rocketing through space faster than a bullet shot out of a gun. At least that's what information has told us through science. Truth is the feeling that we have about being on this earth. And it sure as hell isn't that we're rocketing through space right now, an outgrowth of a living sphere, faster than a bullet shot out of a gun.
Exactly.
We don't feel that. So our truth is different than the fact.
Okay. So now here's where I want to just play around in what you just talked about, that, you know, computer not changing, et cetera. What happens when we get to a point where we have computing devices that can actually monitor through wearables our mood or our heart rate and different things like that, and can present us the information that we need, or the marketing that we need, and the advertising or the sales or anything that's coming through to us, and automates and changes in such a way based upon our move? Is that then fact or truth that it's then impacting for us?
Okay, no, I won't disagree with you that we're going to do amazing things with computers that will aid us in choice and decision making, maybe too much. right? Yeah. Because the minute we start relying on computers to make all the decisions for us, this is the minute that we stop growing as individuals.
Yeah, we're no longer human at that point.
We're not. Yeah, exactly. We're not human anymore. We're being led by them, yep, as opposed to them being our slaves. But is it truth or fact? It's truth. You know, it's truth is always a human construct. It's always what I perceive, I feel, I think about the world. You know, I was having this debate with somebody the other day, and they said, "Well, then truth is purely what we perceive." And I said, "Well, that depends. I mean, the truth is that there are X-rays. I have never seen them. You know, or gamma rays. So is that truth?" Or fact.
Maybe that's the Venn diagram overlap between fact and truth is in that part, where maybe you have to believe it, and or maybe that's faith. I don't know. But
no, faith is completely different.
That's in a different circle. No, but I want to use this. I want to pivot, but on this point, and I want to talk a little bit about your perception, your definition, that is, of brand, and where that overlaps with belief, because I'm really fascinated by, there was a point in my career where I started talking a lot about identity, and I started talking about it completely autonomously from you having your discussions about identity. And then I discovered the stuff you were writing about, and I was like, holy crap, we're talking about the same thing. And I love this concept that we have both talked about, and I'd love for you to talk about a little bit, how identity factors so much into our purchase decisions and into how brands – there's the definition of brand, which the company is defining the brand for themselves, and then there's the consumer that's defining the brand, and that's tied into their identity. Just if you could riff on that a little bit, and you know, what are you seeing nowadays, you know, from the moment that you started writing about that to now, what's happening with the word brand right now?
Yeah. So a brand is what I perceive it to be, right? Mm-hmm. Whoever's making a brand is a choice of something. It's a way of identifying something that someone chooses in the marketplace. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. So in order to choose it, I have to have an expectation of this thing, whatever it happens to be. That expectation that I develop about this thing comes from all kinds of partial information, because I have no idea really about any of these brands. I've never visited any of their companies. I've never talked to their employees. Some of them may be service brands. But it's based on other information that I get through social, through advertising, through some small experiences. I develop an expectation. What that expectation is giving me is this idea that somebody's going to fulfill whatever my feeling is, my desire is. And that desire revolves primarily around three things. One is aesthetics. I look at it and I like the look and feel of it. I say, I like it because I'm like it. You know, I shop there because I'm like that kind of that environment. That's me. The second thing is a sense of control. That's where we're seeing things really take off today, is because that's what digital allows people to do, is give human beings this idea that they have more of a control. Oh, I wear a Fitbit. I must be in control, more in control of my health now. It's not true, but it gives you this sense of control. And then finally, the big one is identity, because we want our identity to be enhanced. When someone makes us feel badly about a decision that we've made, we don't really reflect and say, oh, I don't like them. What we're really feeling is they made me feel bad about me, about my decision. I obviously wasn't smart to do business with these people. So if you can make people feel good about themselves in your presence, give them a sense of control over what they're doing. That's why what you're going to see in the customer service arena is you're going to see chat technology take off. Why? Because when I dial a telephone and nobody picks up and I hit like seven different numbers to try to reach a human being, I feel like I've lost control. When I go on a website and a chat box pops up and somebody says, can I help you? And I said, yeah, please do this for me. I feel like I'm in control. And then, like I said, the third thing is aesthetics. But you see what's happening with technology, because technology now is so inexpensive. Anybody can put up a website that looks like the website of a billion-dollar company. Mm-hmm. So you really, through aesthetics, we don't have an idea of who anyone is anymore. Is this a big company or is this a guy in his basement? Yeah. I'm not sure. So those are the three components of what defines to people a brand. And if somebody says to me price, oh no, but what about price? That's part of identity. Well, I know people, rich people that find $4 lamps at like Goodwill, and they'll say, I found this lamp at Goodwill. It has nothing to do with the price. It has to do with their identity of being some kind of, you know, bargain hunter or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've said a lot of very similar things that basically, you know, what a product is doing when you buy it is telling you a little bit of a story about yourself. You know, I wear red Pumas. That's my thing. And I say it's my thing because I like it being my thing, because to me it makes me different. And if I see somebody else doing it, it's a shot to the identity that I've created. So I totally get this. Where question for you?
But
is,
you see it. You see yourself reflective. This is what smart people don't understand. Just because you see it and I see it, we start assuming, well, everybody must see this. That's the mistake humans make. Was we think things and then we look at others and we think they're thinking what we're thinking.
Oh, that's been my biggest problem in my business is I think that everybody gets how simple it is to design a social strategy. I'm like, well, obviously they get this, and then I say like three parts of it and they're baffled. So exactly. that's been a real challenge for me. But speaking of social and this conversation of brand, specifically looking at the aesthetics, the control, the identity, I think. I'm fascinated. One of the reasons why I got involved in social, you know, I started tinkering around with social and thinking of it as a career option. Sometime around 2005, I started really playing with it. And then in 2007, I said, you know what? Yes, I'm doing this. Because I saw a huge shift that was about to happen, very similar like you said about chat technology, where we got a sense of control. I feel like social gave us that feeling of control, that we mm-hmm. could take a brand down if we wanted to, that we had a voice. And I think that gives us a greater say in brand, which means that if people have a greater say in and greater control over the perception of brand, that must mean that we have a control in at least one of these three different areas, either control, aesthetics, or identity, due to this new technology. And I think one of the things I'm seeing in the shift in social when I look at it from a macro perspective is that what was once a wide open, flat, democratized kind of web where everybody had a voice is now starting to get throttled as more and more content comes out there. It's more noisy. We have the Facebook algorithm. Blogs are kind of being shut down and everything's moving through, you know, the Borg, either mm-hmm. the Google Borg or the Facebook one. I wonder, is that a move to pull some of that control that people have in brand and return it back to the quote-unquote the big brand?
I don't think that that's what's going on. I think that it's a battle for attention. So I think the Facebooks and the Googles are really smart at trying to figure out how to take all this fragmented attention and have it filtered through their brand. And what happened is the media companies let them do that. You know, they didn't have to do that. They could have said, no, we don't want you. We don't want any links. We don't want anything published on your Facebook page. But they didn't. They used that platform to drive views to their platforms. And now what they're finding out are people sometimes don't even leave Facebook. They just come to Facebook, they read some little article right there, and then that's it. They never even hit the brand website. So that's just a battle for attention. And because human beings are, you know, we're lazy. We're looking for the simplest, easiest way to make our way through the day. And if I can go to one place and find what I'm looking for, that's where I'm going to go. I'm not going to go searching all over the place like we used to in the past. And I think that that's what you're seeing as far as this, you know, this consolidation of information into these different platforms. And it's going to just continue unless someone can figure out how to break you away from that platform. So, you know what it's like? It's like the retail outlets, right? So what did Walmart do? They did the exact same thing that Facebook is doing on the retail level. They said, look, why do you have to drive around to all these little stores? We'll give it to you for a lower price in this one big store. It's a lot easier. Just drive in here. So that's what people did. And then all these little stores went out of business.
So you've got my brain spinning in a couple different ways, and I think, you know, the main thing I want to start with is this idea that humans are lazy and we go towards the easier thing, which I think would be virtually impossible to dispute. But as we see, you know, attention spans are shortening. There's this, you know, very, very quotable stat that our attention spans are now shorter than goldfish due to smartphones and this and that. And I would postulate that it's the reason why everybody keeps looking for, quote unquote, the next big thing, is because we're looking for the thing that's going to make it even easier because we're lazy and don't want to do the hard work.
Right.
That would be my first thought. But the I think the Walmart example is an interesting one, and I'm curious your thoughts if you play this out, because, you know, you've been in this business longer than I have, and you've seen things and you think about things. My question is this: from my viewpoint, this is a repeating pattern that exists throughout the universe, and I call it the universal law of expansion and contraction. And it's this idea that if you look at, you know, for one of the examples I've used in the past is that breweries in the United States hit a certain peak, and then all of a sudden they started getting that prohibition happened, basically, and then there was a steep climb, and then all of the breweries, the little craft breweries, started getting bought up by the bigger ones, and everything started tasting like the same kind of beer, and it dropped to like 70 or 80 breweries, and then people got tired of that thing and started creating craft breweries again, and now the craft breweries started cropping up, and then basically the big guys started buying up the craft breweries. So the right. Walmart is a great example. It's the same sort of thing. So they said, why go to all these stores when you can come to one place and that grows and it scales and it becomes this big thing? And then people say, well, you know what? I actually want something with a little bit more character. I want the bargain hunting. So I think this comes back to the identity thing, is that our identity, our natural human inclination, I think, is to not want to be the same as everybody else. It's to carve out our own identity so that we feel that we have an identity. So if we're moving towards this place in social where we're all hoarding our attention in one place and all of a sudden Google and Facebook own the majority of it, isn't it natural that then something else would crop up, like, for instance, Snapchat, and we would begin to go to that? So do you see this cycle kind of perpetuating itself again, or are we going to reach the tipping point where eventually we all just become slaves to the machine?
Okay, so what you can see what's happening. I think your brewery example is better than my Walmart example, because what's happening today are these brands are a lot smarter than they were in the past. They don't buy up these niche brands that have built these strong identities. They don't buy them up and then suck them into the corporate, you know, machine and destroy that uniqueness. They buy them and leave them alone and let them do their thing.
I see what you're doing there, yeah.
Right? You see what I'm saying? So yep. The Ben and Jerry's, who you used to think was, you know, these two hippies, it's not them. It's Unilever, right? But they leave them alone. Leave them alone. And that's what's going on with all the with these small breweries. They're all being gobbled up. And that's the same thing that's going to happen with Facebook and Google.
Yep.
They're going to see this unique thing and gobble it up.
Instagram and WhatsApp, right. And they're just going to leave it alone. Just own it.
Leave it alone. Let them do their thing.
Well, I think that's probably preferable, right, to homogenizing the experience.
Yeah. You know, I honestly believe that there's going to be an explosion of brands to deal with these unique identities that you're talking about. But it's probably, I don't know that it's going to happen in that sphere. You know, in the information sphere. I'm not sure. I don't know. Only because I know how lazy people are with information. You know, they think that if it's easy to get, it's true. I don't know where that comes from. It's something that goes on in the mind as well. Whatever your mind can retrieve the fastest, your mind says that must be true. Whether or not it's true or not. That's what advertising's all about. They keep throwing this stuff out there so that it's easy for your mind to just, that must be true. That must be the greatest, whatever it is. I've heard it so many times.
Easily retrievable. So, it's more difficult to think for that right answer, right?
Right. So why would you go someplace else for information? Unless, again, it's to validate some type of identity, and that's why you have like the Fox News versus the CNNs and things like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I want to. I know we both have limited time, and also I could honestly talk to you for hours about different things. But I'd rather just invite you to come back at another time. But I want to leave us on one last question. I want to play around with a little bit before I close this one out. But I read your stuff. I've seen you speak, And I can't tell for the life of me whether you're optimistic or pessimistic or realistic about what's happening out there. I just think you're very thoughtful. And I want to kind of just ask what, you know, you look out into your crystal ball, you look at the future and you see what's out there. Are you optimistic about where we're going or pessimistic? Or do you just see it is what it is and you just like thinking about it? I mean, where are you on it?
When you say optimistic or pessimistic about what?
I mean about everything. You know, like look, humans are lazy. Is that going to get us in trouble, or are we going to rebound from that, or is that it is just what it is? Or you know, when we talk about brands and how some are just awful at it and some are great at it, or the Trump effect, or any of these different things.
Yeah, I think you just made the case for how I feel exactly. Some are going to be good at it. Some are going to be terrible at it. The more and more people that are terrible, that's good for the people who are good at it, because that gives them an advantage now to go in there and do some amazing things. It like you said, this contraction and expansion, it's the same thing with humans, right? As soon as we start thinking things like, oh God, things are bad, we're running out of fossil fuels, bam, somebody like invents something and oh, holy cow. So we can make electricity out of salt water, and oh, we're never going to run out. So I can't predict the future, and I know we're not going to just go along some kind of linear path. There's going to be some discovery. Some brand's going to come around from – listen, do I think Facebook is going to, like, take over the world? No. Something is going to come along, and it's going to knock them for a loop, just like they knocked everybody for a loop.
Yep.
That's just the way the world works, and that's what should turn on any entrepreneur out there that looks at these people and says, "Oh, but look how big they are! How can we possibly forget it? They weren't always big. Everybody starts off small. I don't know anybody that starts big. Nothing starts big. An oak tree starts small. Everything starts small.
Yep.
But it seems to scare people today." Wow, there's all these big companies out there. You know, maybe I shouldn't. Of course you should start something if you feel passionate about it. That's how everything great starts.
Awesome. You know what? I think that is the perfect point to leave us on. Tom, where can people go and find out more about you, about your books, about where to connect with you and be social with you online?
Well, I think the easiest place to remember would be thebusinessofbelief.com, and that'll take them to my website and my books and all of that, and they can connect with me, and there's links to Twitter, all that.
All right, so. Cool, and I'll throw your Twitter on there as well. So I'll throw Tom Asacker and the Business of Belief right in the show notes. Tom,
thanks, Jeff.
I'm so freaking glad that we got to jump on here and just chat.
Let's do it again. It was fun.
Awesome. Yes, I would love for you to come back and chat again. So for all of you out there listening, re-listen to this episode again, because you probably didn't catch everything. I know I'm going to. So, Tom, thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the True Voice Media Podcast, and you made it all the way to the end of the episode. I'm proud of you. But now that you're here, this is what we're going to need you to do. First of all, head on over to your favorite podcast platform and give us a rating. If you don't know where to start, go to truevoicemedia.com/feedback. Next, if you're not yet a subscriber, it's time you fix that. Head over to truevoicemedia.com/podcast to subscribe by iTunes, Stitcher, or email. If you really want to show us some love, visit our partners and sponsors who help make this show possible. I know the show feels free, but trust me, it's not. I sure ain't done publishing these episodes, so I sure hope you're not done listening. I'll see you on the next one. Take care.